We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Actor, writer and comedian Kulvinder Gear first shot to fame in 1987 when he played Aslam in the coming-of-age movie Rita Sue and Bob 2. Just a decade later, Gear found TV success writing and performing on the seminal 90s sketch show Goodness Gracious Me, alongside fellow British Asian performers Sanjeev Bhaskar, Meera Sayal and Nina Wadia. Starring opposite the legendary Sir David Jason for the sequel to the corner shop classic sitcom Still Open All Hours, cemented his status as one of Britain's most versatile actors. In 2019, he played the protagonist's father in the Bruce Springsteen-inspired comedy blockbuster Blinded by the Light. I caught up with the comedy star to talk films, TV and the boss. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Kulvinder Gear. Is it fair to say that your first major role came in the 1987 film Rita Sue and Bob 2? How did this film capture the societal shift of the late 80s, and why do you think it remains such a cult classic?
I would say, yeah, it was a major role. Only prior to that, I had done a series called Howard's Way and another sitcom called, only a small part in it called No Problem. But my break in one respect was Rita Sue. And it was of its time, but a really important time, because the character I was playing, he was of that generation. Somebody was born in Yorkshire and off there. And I remember when I, if you watch the sketch today, when the actress goes up for the audition,
yeah,
that was more or less when I went up for the audition for Rita Sue. First thing, I was too young for it. The character they were looking was about 32. I was 22 years old then, and I didn't have an Indian accent. I had a very northern Yorkshire accent, and the actual part was actually written in Indian. And I actually turned around to Alan Clark and said, "Do I sound like a Paki to you?" And he said, "No." I said, "Why then? Why use it? Are we just using it for humour?" And I think that did me good stead. And he said, "No, just do it as yourself."
In 1996, you teamed up with Sanjeev Bhaskar, Meera Sayal and Nina Wadia for the BBC Radio 4 sketch show Goodness Gracious Me, as we've just been talking about. What sort of obstacles did you encounter on the way to securing the show for broadcast?
See, it was quite strange because prior to that I'd been working on The Real McCoy. So when The Real McCoy came to a fruition, like Anil said, there was an opportunity here maybe to do an Asian sketch show. Obstacles were finance. Yeah. There wasn't that much money available. So the simple path we took was towards radio. And I think that stead us good, because it stead the BBC good as well, because it made them review of how they should develop programming. And they went the old-fashioned way, just like the Goons, doing the live radio shows, and that's what we did. And in one sense, that built a really good literal side of that sketch show, and before it went into television. So we had reworked it with the radio, which became more literal and better for it, and then visualised it with the television series.
Why do you think radio is the most popular route into comedy?
Well, the radio is not only for comedy a popular route. I think for any form of drama, whether it be comedy or it's a great route. We are from a country that's been known for its literature, and I think literature is very important here, and where we can hear literature. Great thing about radio is that you make your own visions and you give your own images, like any book, any decent novel. And another great thing for radio is not only the community based of radio, of getting in touch with a particular community that you're involved with, it makes you very close to that community, so you can keep your hands on the levels that you want to write about and the people that you want to introduce. Obviously, they say it's cheaper. And to develop new ideas, new visions, new pieces of work, radio really lends itself for that. It's very, very flexible media to work in. So it's very important that we don't lose this. Because recently we've been hearing cuts within the BBC of getting rid of community radio. But if we lose that strand, I think we're going to lose a lot of stories, which is going to be sad in one way.
The show Goodness Gracious Me followed a now recognised route which has spawned many of our best loved comedy shows of the last 20 years, including Miranda, Little Britain and The League of Gentlemen. Why do you think the show was able to make the seamless transition from radio to TV?
Again, it's always it's a development then, because we're developing, we're searching, we're finding new ways. I mean, in one sense, The Real McCoy went straight into TV. It didn't go into radio, but it didn't do it any favours, I think. Whereas Goodness Gracious Me, we originally put it on as a theatre piece, so visually people came and watched it. And then to transgress it, because they didn't have money to give us a teleseries, but they had a little space for Radio 4 or us to go and do like the Goon Show, which was amazing, which really gave us the confidence in the work that we were developing. And I think because of that journey, of workshopping that, we really got really good, crisp, clean scripts. And with the good script editor, we can make those, you know, make them snappier and sharper and develop the skill of writing sketches.
Iconic sketches, including Going Out for an English and Chubbly's, have become part of the comedy psyche. In what way do you think it was the perfect time to subvert the vicarious relationship between white British and multiculturalism? And how did you capture the mood of the time?
Well, when you're a generation that's... in one sense, as an observer, because I wasn't born here, I came here and couldn't speak a lot of English. So you learn the language, you learn to adapt, you learn to be diverse, you learn to do all those old-fashioned words like fusion come in. So naturally, you embrace the culture that you've come into as well. And when you're going to, and people are meeting, they're socializing, but at the same time, we're not making those bridges. And I think with these programs, what they did start doing was making people talk to each other. And to say there is nothing to hide here and there's nothing to be frightened of, because we're not that different. You know, it is in one sense the thickness of your skin that we are troubled with. But the rest of it, even culture-wise, you know, we're not that different. We can laugh together, and that's the celebration here.
And in your opinion, what were the differences between this style of comedy and someone like Michael Bates in It Ain't Half Hot Mum, or the satirical tone of Johnny Spate?
See, another thing is when you get good actors and you get committed actors who work this craft, you have to look at yourself as an artist. You can't look at yourself in a cultural identity. And I always done that. I never looked at myself as a particular being. I love being an artist. I love being an actor. And that is a choice, you know, you can be, and that was the fun of it. You can be anybody you like, anything. You can even be a domestic object. You don't look at in the ideas of, you get rid of those filters. Because humor is much more stronger when that comes in. So I don't think, as an actor, I've always looked at it to approach work, the responsibility of the character and the part that you've been given, and to be responsible for that. And if you can get an array of parts to play, whether it be in theatre, film or television or even radio, you can really nurture those skills.
In 2014, the cast of Goodness Gracious Me reunited to commemorate 50 years of BBC Two, followed by two more reunions in the succeeding years. What was it like to get back together all these years later?
I always say it's like putting on an old suit, but it's a little bit tight on the edges. Maybe you've put on a bit too much weight. You know, but it fits. It fits. Whether... And another thing to notice with comedy like that, it developing the comedy, and whether you can revive it and bring it back together, But if people are still watching it and they're still relating to it, you know, obviously there's a demand for it. But I think there is a different time and new sketches, and we can maybe produce a different type of work where it doesn't have to be a point of view from a particular culture. It can be a very British point of view.
But of course, by this time, you were starring alongside the legendary Sir David Jason for Still Open All Hours.
Yeah.
How daunting is it to star in a revival of a comedy classic?
Very daunting, because you have to join a new bunch of troop of actors as much as a new writers. And but in Still Open All Hours, it came very easy for me because the North, I could relate very easy to it because I grew up in Leeds. To work with Jason was fantastic because you actually see how a master works, how somebody uses timing and gets into, and each time it's preparation and preparation, you're preparing. And as you're working with script with him, you are working with him to find the humour with you, and he's very open that way. So as much as it may be daunting for the actors that have been in the old Open All Hours, what was nice was that some of the old members did come back. And to be part of that was just kind of an honour, really, a privilege.
Did you watch it when you were growing up?
I watched some of it, yes, Still Open All Hours, as much as Last of the Summer Wine, because they're Roy Clark pieces. And they were northern based. So when you're from there, you know, you felt all of a sudden the cotton wool and the comfort of those two beautiful comedies and the humour that they have. And it was just a joy, because it's not threatening humour, see. It's really the simplicity of it is beautiful.
In 2019, you starred in the heartwarming comedy blockbuster Blinded by the Light, based on the music of Bruce Springsteen. How much did you know about The Boss prior to this, and what were your first impressions of the role?
I heard of The Boss, but not as much as Safraj Manzoor, the writer of the piece and the novel, brought it home to me, how much it meant to him and his father, in one sense. So now it's sort of ingrained in you a little bit about Springsteen, about his history and his music, and the meaning behind that music. Like great artists, you know, they have so many layers within their work and so much of them in there. And it was just an honour to be working on that film, and based on Safraj's true story of his life growing up in Luton. And what I did love about it was, sadly, in one sense, Safraj never got to say some of those things that he said, what he wanted to say to his father in the film, because he passed away, his father. And that's why the ending was a sense of release for Safraj, to an acceptance of his father taking on this life of as an artist, a writer, a journalist, you know.
Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Oh, wow, my two kids. It has to be. You know, we are so much absorbed in this work, and sometimes we forget to live life to the full. And having those two precious things, those pieces of sculpture, as they have grown older now, and that's been a joy. And the whole 40 years, in one respect, it's one whole parcel wrapped up. I couldn't really ask for more, because you get to see many different strands within this work, as much as TIE Theatre in Education, working up there in Manchester, as much as you're working in different and developing new pieces of work, to the extreme of the last job was Foundation, working with Apple TV, creating this amazing piece of work by a novelist they call him the godfather of sci-fi, Isaac Asimov's these great five novels which are set 30,000 years in the future. So I always look at my last job and I say, if I've enjoyed that, that just inspires you to carry on further.
And I guess leading on from that, what's next for Corvinda Gear?
Again, I think I go back to writing. When there's moments when you find there's gap between parts, again, you want parts that want to be challenging you. Whether they come out of theatre, film or television or radio, but they need to be challenging. So I've come to a point where I'm looking for work where is going to push me a little bit more further within the characters I want to play. But then again, it's to continually develop work. So I've been writing with a couple of good friends, and hopefully we can shift those. They are very adventurous processes, as much as programming that you want to make. But I think that if we can get a couple of them off the ground, it would be fantastic. Do you hear me, BFI? You know,
so in time we'll come back here and see if you managed to get it made.
Yeah, but that's an adventure, isn't it?
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.